Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Well, it's the sound that takes you to another sound.
Welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. We are a daily music podcast that publishes every weekday. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of my co-host, co-founder, and great friend Jim Linehan, I want to say happy Thursday to you, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of our show. As we record this right now, I got to tell you that we are getting down to the final four, down to the nitty-gritty of our American Band Madness bracket. So if you want to have an impact, if you want to have a say on who steps atop the podium as the greatest American band, we need you to vote in the upcoming days. That means go to Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is @SuburbsPod. And just place your vote. It's very, very important. These are vital matchups. These teams have all come through. These bands have all come through and won several head-to-head matchups, sometimes by the slimmest of margins, and in other cases by massive margins. But they're still there, and we need you to help us decide who's going to be number one. I will tell you, too, programming-wise, there's going to be some update episodes on the American Band Madness coming up. We're going to be recording some this weekend and also early next week as we get down to the winner. So it is here. Final Four weekend is here. Oh, and also, I guess they're playing a basketball tournament, huh? And, boy, did anyone have that Final Four in their bracket? It's not the teams closest to a certain southern fast food chain, which I happen to find delicious. Okay, I also want to remind you of a couple other things. One relating to college basketball. I really want you guys to, if you haven't already, go back and listen to yesterday's episode when I gave some examples of concerts I have seen in college basketball arenas. And I'm very excited because we're already starting to get some submissions in. We got one from Joe Fleischer that I can't wait for you guys to hear. So that's going to be coming up soon. I also want to tell you that it is March new music time, so start rounding up your picks. We've only got 2 days left in the month of March as you hear this, so you want to see what's coming out tomorrow, if there's anything groundbreaking that's going to change your picks. And then you've got till April 7th, give you another week to get all those in. We've already got some coming in, and I appreciate everybody who's already submitted one either through the email address or on our Suburban Party line. Now, I'll tell you, there's two differences between the call-outs I just made. For the college basketball stories, you can get those to us anyhow. If you want to post a comment on social media or Twitter or Facebook, that's fine. We'll get those rounded up. If you want to email us and just write it down, we can read it out. That's rock@suburbspod.com. And, of course, you can attach a voice file there, or you can go ahead and call our Suburban Party line. It's just pick up the phone and give us a call over there on the Google Voice line. It is 612-440-1984. With all that out of the way, we're going to take a moment today to mark an album anniversary. It's not one of those neat and tidy ones like 50 or 75 or 20 or 25, but on this day, March 30th, 1970, a record was released that had profound impact for many, many years and is still impacting people. And it impacted many, many kinds of music, not just rock and roll that we talk about a lot on this show, but also jazz, jazz fusion, jazz rock, experimental music, even funk music. And the record is Miles Davis' Bitches Brew. It was recorded August 19th to 21st, 1969. I believe it was done in three sessions that lasted from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. each day. There were very few things planned out about this session. Miles gave the assembled musicians a few small lines to follow and a few small keys to attempt to work in, but that's about all he did. He desperately wanted the musicians to listen to each other. The record was released, as I said, the next spring on the Columbia Records label, and the record was recorded at Columbia 52nd Street Studio in New York City. It is a remarkable piece of music. I'm holding in front of me a copy of the original double LP Columbia Stereo GP26 with an amazing cover painting on the front that actually overlaps to the back, and it's kind of a psychedelic painting that's reuniting Earth, all different races of humanity, Mother Nature as well, as far as I can see, and that's just a quick reading of what the cover is. There's a picture of Miles on the inside here. And key, there's a picture of Miles and Tio Macero, the producer that had been working with Miles. Now, the record that Miles put out before this, called In a Silent Way, was released in 1969 in February. And that record sort of set the tone for what was going to happen here. Interestingly enough, there were short chunks of music recorded for In a Silent Way. And I want to read something very quickly about that record. We won't dwell on it too much, but this is from what I call the Bible, the Penguin Guide to Jazz on CD, LP, and cassette. The Bible of Jazz for me. It says, quote, and I'm talking about In a Silent Way here. In order to bring the performances up to LP length, Tio Macero stitched repeats of certain passages back into the fabric of the music, giving it continuity and a certain hypnotic circularity. Once again, the practical contingency, Miles was apparently happy with the short chunks of music that had been recorded, resulted in a new creative development, no less significant than Charles Mingus overdubbing on The Black Saint and The Sinner Lady. The path was cleared for something even more extraordinary. Now, with Bitches Brew, I don't necessarily know if that was a stated plan between Miles and Tio, but so Miles and the group got together and they recorded these pieces of music with direction, you know, some direction and some melody lines. Some of the group had played this stuff with Miles throughout the late winter and early spring of 1970 as they were playing shows. But then they sort of laid it all out there in these different ways, and there was all this stuff. And then later, Tao came back and used a lot of different special effects, tape loops, editing, reverb chambers, echo, and just really created a new way to make music. Essentially, this is one of the very first records in jazz and in other places, and I know the Beatles have been doing some stuff along these lines as well, but to really, in the jazz world, to not only use the studio as another instrument, but use all the electronic effects as another instrument, and to take jazz music and to mix it with funk, to mix it with avant-garde, what doing that did was essentially create jazz fusion. And it created not only jazz fusion, but it created the ability for other musics to be fused together. And I know there were some fusion things that were going on here and there and other different places, but this was a conscious effort by a mainstream star on a major label to use this very forward-thinking technique and to put it all together. And that was the ripple effect it had. Suddenly, fusion music was a thing. Bands like Weather Report and Spyro Gyra and Shadow Facts and all that entire genre of music kind of comes in many ways from Bitches Brew. It also opened up the idea of a lot of rock musicians that you could start doing all this editing and overlapping and tape effects and all this kind of stuff. And also opened up the idea that jazz was no longer this sort of older style of music that was just listened to by some old dudes in like pork pie hats, and it was just saxophones and trumpets and drums, and that's all it could be. Electric guitar and electric bass suddenly were part of the picture, and it's just a remarkable achievement in many, many ways. Plus, it's fun as hell to listen to. It's Miles, up to this point, most aggressive trumpet playing. The band is just cooking in this very unusual way. It's just like this giant python has been released into your head or into your room or into your earphones when you put this music on, and it just slithers around and does all this stuff, and it's all menacing, and times it's got you wrapped up, and times you're just like in awe standing there looking at it and watching it sort of do its thing, flick its eyes and tongue and pulse around. I mean, it's just a remarkable piece of music. You just start with the first side and you play it over and over and over, and eventually it reveals itself to you in many ways, but the charms of it are pretty apparent on first listen. I mean, you can just listen to it for the funky groove or the weird tape delays at first, and then it continues to unfurl on you. And I know there have been some criticisms of the record saying that, you know, the players weren't in tune and it was just so loose and it wasn't really funky and all that, but that's all hindsight. That's all after other funky things have been made and other, you know, things have been done. There's just so much that came together in this music. And I find it to be really, really amazing. And I just wanted to take a minute and talk about it. I want to read a couple things. The Penguin Guide to Jazz on CD, LP, and cassette. They say, quote, "This is one of the most remarkable creative statements of the last 50 years in any form. It is also profoundly flawed, a gigantic torso of burstingly noisy music that absolutely refuses to resolve itself formally." And that's a great point, because the music doesn't really take you anywhere or leave you in a certain spot. It just kind of is there. And that's pretty fascinating, too. Not a lot of people were doing that kind of thing. Most people had a song, and even in jazz, here's the theme, here's where we solo, here's where it ends. None of that is existent in this music whatsoever. And I should tell you, too, the players on this record. I'm going to open up my original copy here that I've had for a while, and it's definitely kind of worn out. The bottom is split, but the records are in pretty good shape. On all cuts, Miles Davis on trumpet, Wayne Shorter on soprano sax, Lenny White on drums, Benny Maupin on bass clarinet, Chick Corea electric piano, Jim Riley percussion, Jack DeJohnette drums, Harvey Brooks Fender bass, Charles Alias on drums, Dave Holland on bass, John McLaughlin on electric guitar, and on some tunes add Joe Sawino, of course, on electric piano, Larry Young on electric piano. So you hear there was a lot of different players, several drummers, a percussionist, a couple different kinds of bass, multiple keyboard players. Again, the Penguin Guide to Jazz says the electric keyboards create a shimmer out of which Miles stabs out some of his most maximal trumpet playing on record. Hordes of ideas packed together in a relatively small space on Miles Runs the Voodoo Down. A great song title that really kind of gets you into the essence of what's happening here. There's something, there's some kind of spirit that Miles is chasing, and they're using all kinds of different ways to do it. He was very, very much in motion during this period of his career and would later go on to make more overtly funky records, and then later on in his career go back to more modal kind of jazz playing. But this record profoundly changed him and profoundly changed all of music for a long, long time. And every March 30th, maybe that's a good time to just dig it out. The record was originally issued and mixed for quadraphonic sound, and I think you had to have a special kind of stereo to do that. Contact the Flaming Lips, they may know something about that. But it's also been reissued on CD, a very fine CD reissue set from Columbia with excellent liner notes and a few extra tracks and different takes and things like that. And there's a whole cult of Bitches Brew people that have written books about it and studied it and everything. But it is a remarkable achievement that really needs to be marked. So let's mark that down on our calendars. Every March 30th, we'll take the time to investigate Bitches Brew. I do want to mention, too, that the record came out, and it didn't sell tremendously well at first, but it continued to sell steadily throughout its release and continued in the 80s and the 90s and continued to sell, and eventually, you know, changed the way I think a lot of labels and music executives viewed what jazz could possibly be, because certainly some of these fusion groups sold a lot of copies. Jazz funk bands became very, very popular. There was all kinds of tinges. Jazz rock, of course. You know, you think of Blood, Sweat, and Tears and some of the things that happened with fusing other styles into rock music. And it totally changed, I think, the idea of commercial landscape for a lot of these records, all of which was done without Miles necessarily aping anybody's style. He certainly was paying attention to funk music at the time, and he was also listening to all kinds of different stuff. And Teo Macero was someone who had a classical education and was inspired by Music Concrete experiments and knew the French composer Varese, I think is how you say it. It was somebody that his family knew, and he was doing all kinds of modern things, and you could say Zappa was doing some stuff along these lines as well, but it wasn't necessarily Miles trying to take somebody's idea to a next generation. It was just a whole bunch of things that were out there that were influencing him, all funneled through his vision, along with Teo putting it all together after the fact. It turned out to be a remarkable, enduring statement. It still sounds as fresh and as strange and as sinister today as it did, I guess, in 1970. I was pretty small then. I don't think I had a stereo yet to get it. And I'm pretty sure my parents didn't have this record sitting around, because that would have really freaked me out. And, one last thing I want to read here before we close out, and we'll hear some of the title track as we go out. But I do encourage you to go out and listen to the whole thing. That's one reason I didn't play a whole lot of clips in this episode, because it's really best consumed as a whole. So go out there and get it, whether it's on vinyl or CD or just streaming. It's just something you have to experience if you haven't. And if you have, let's start a new tradition and revisit it every March 30th. How about that? All right. So I will read this. The whole package, writes the authors of the Penguin Guide to Jazz, the whole package is less of a performance in the old-fashioned sense than an artifact, the details of which are secondary to the overall effect. And that, for all the sheer awkwardness of some passages and internal inconsistency of much of the music, is a shattering achievement. Ah, deep breath, and we will continue to contemplate the glory that is Bitches Brew by Miles Davis, 1970. Alrighty, folks, we will be back with another episode tomorrow, and I want to remind you about those little prompts we had, the college basketball concerts, March New Music, and of course the American Band Madness. I am Patrick Foster. It's been a pleasure to put this little thing together for you. On behalf of Jim Linehan, my great friend, I want to tell you guys, we'll talk to you tomorrow. We'll be right back. Overtly funky, 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 overtly feel earth, we can 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 feel earth, we